This is an excerpt from Dance For Me, a novel that was written a couple of years ago. The novel tells the story of Maria, who lives in Cambodia, and she has a sister who becomes very ill, and the sustenance farmer that is her parent goes to town to try to find a doctor, but there is no money. So without money, he barters and does return to the village with a doctor, but he sends his elder daughter, Melia, away under the pretense of working as a domestic servant to pay off the debt. In reality, Melia has been sold to a brothel, and this is the story of her time there. In this excerpt, Melia is coming out of a terrible night in which she was put in one of the cells and tortured, starved. So in this book, as in many of the real life instances of trafficking and brothels, the real evil is with the brothel owners or the people who purchase these girls. So this is the story. So again, please note that any of the work on this blog is expressly copyrighted, and please don't steal my work. But I've written a lot, and over 100 books total, 9 of which are published, and out of all of them, Dance For Me is probably the one that I am the most proud of. And it's also ironic because my story is not the same as these girls. But when I was doing the research for this book, I recognized some of the same feelings and thoughts I had myself that were described by survivors of sex trafficking. So I see pieces of myself in Melia's thoughts, and it reminds me that ultimately, although each of our circumstances and each of our stories are different, the pain is the same, and that is what connects us. That, and the elusive hope. Dear U, Madame let me out of the room at the end of that awful day. I wasn't caged up inside the cell anymore, but I knew I would never be the same. When I walked out of the room, I didn't look over my shoulder to see if Small followed me. I knew he hadn't. I wasn't scared. I wasn't scared of Madame. I wasn't scared of the men anymore, either. Something broke inside of me in that cell. I didn't know what it was. I still don't know what it was. But I knew something had. The look I'd seen in the other girl's eyes, the one I swore would never be in mine, now was. When Vosnia asked me where I'd been, I didn't answer her. When Sahit put her hand on my shoulder, I hunched over in a ball until she let go. They knew. They knew something awful happened. And I think Sahit knew about the cell. She told Vosnia to be quiet, that it couldn't be talked about. I didn't learn how to fight at home. At home, there was nothing to fight about. If I wanted something, I either got it or I didn't. Arguing was never even thought about. I'd never heard raised voices or said no. I'd said no to the men a few times before the cell, and I'd begged Madame to stop the killer from touching me. But that hadn't really been fighting. I just sort of let it happen because that was all I knew. I'd never been to school. I didn't know how to stop something from happening. And I was too shocked. I didn't know things like this happened at all. I thought all people were good. I thought men were good. Uncle was good, and you were good. No one had ever hurt me. No one had ever hit me. No one had ever stuck me deep inside. I didn't know what pain was. So, until the day in the cell, I was just too shocked to think much of anything. I thought of you and Thérèse and May, and when that became too painful, and I couldn't think of you anymore, I thought of Small and how he was going to get me the key. But then there was no mouse hole. Small was real. I know he was because I saw him. Or did I? Maybe even that was a dream. All I know is when there wasn't a mouse hole, when there was no door in that room for Small to get through, it burned away the shock, leaving someone inside of me I didn't recognize. I wasn't sweet anymore, Ew. I wasn't playful. And when I looked at the other girls, I saw their eyes in mine. We were robots, going through the motions to stay alive, but why? Why bother? There was no way out. Sometimes I thought it was better to be dead. Sometimes I was jealous of the girls who disappeared and never came back. I told myself I was jealous because it meant they got away. By now I was 12. I knew they really hadn't gotten away. I knew they'd been killed. Still, I was jealous. Most days, being dead was better than living. Whatever else I was after that day, I was dutiful. I would never again claw the face of another client. I would never again put up such a fight that the men complained. I was dutiful. The highest honor a daughter can bring to her parents is by being dutiful, isn't it? If that's true, then maybe you would be proud of me, because I didn't complain after that. Not even to the girls. I didn't talk at all. I just did what I had to do without thinking about it, hoping to survive, kind of. If I didn't, I didn't really care anymore. I am gone from there now. I am out. But I am still cold. I still don't laugh. I still have the same look in my eyes. I'm not even sure I'm human anymore. I'm not sure I'll ever be human again. I wish I could say I miss you, Ooh. Sometimes I think I do, but instead of a flame, it's a flicker, a wisp of something instead of a strong wind. I love you, except I don't know what love is anymore. Love saves a daughter. Love sends another daughter to the brothel. Love cries because the daughter is gone. Love laughs. I saw you laughing, even though she still isn't home. Do you know what you were doing when you sent me away? Did you know it would be forever? Is that why May was worried? Love, I don't understand the word anymore. It sounded familiar, but the meaning is lost. My mind is broken. It must be because I don't think about anything now. I just do. I get up, I find something to eat, I work some days, I sleep. Then I do it all over again and again. I'm not angry. I'm not sad. I'm not happy. I'm not relieved. Not anything, really. I just am. I stare straight ahead to keep my eye on whatever goal is in front of me and just do it. And when it is done, I search for something else to do. Because that's what good daughters should do. That's what dutiful daughters should do. And I don't know anything anymore. Except that I should want to be a good and dutiful daughter. Chapter 10. I've been laying in this same position all day long. I am curled up on the floor, my arms wrapped around my belly. Hunger gnaws, but I barely notice. The girls talk behind me. I don't care. I want to move from this spot ever again. I don't want to eat. I don't want to roll over. Most of the time, I keep my eyes closed. But right now, I stare at the cold wall in front of me. There is a clock in my head that keeps counting down the minutes. I have another hour before work starts. 60 minutes to be left alone. 60 minutes to not have anything to do. No one to smile at. No one's hands on me. Nothing to smell, nothing to taste, nothing. They say that a person's soul is inside her head. And if that's true, I don't have a soul because there isn't anything in my head anymore. Broken. Doesn't think anymore. Got tunnel vision and sees only one thing at a time. And right now, its thing is how many minutes are left in the hour. The room does not have a clock. I've never seen a real one, but May drew me pictures once of one and taught me how to tell time. I don't remember anything else I learned at home. Melia, it is so hot. She sounds worried. I don't answer. Melia, are you going to be all right tonight? I don't answer. My belly is so hungry. It starts floating back and forth. Makes me feel queasy like I'm going to get sick. Instead, I grit my teeth and close my eyes. I do not answer, Sahib. She goes away, and I am glad. There are 44 minutes left in the hour. Melia, this time it is Bosnia. I do not answer. Melia, if you don't get it together, Madame will do it again. You've got to snap out of this. She means well. She is trying to help. She probably really is worried about Madame. She is wasting energy worrying. Being scared doesn't change what's going to happen. So you shouldn't be scared. You are better served by fighting. Or, if you can't fight, by run. For the first time since I've been back in this room, I try to open my mouth. I can't because it is so dry. I run my tongue over my lips and try again. I want to get out of here. Yeah. Well, good luck on that. Champai speaks up. I've been trying to get out of here for 3 years. 3 years. At first, that number, 3 years, sticks like glue in my head. There are 365 days in 1 year. That means Champai has already been here for 1,095 days. 1,095 days. I don't feel proud that I knew how to add that up so fast because Sahib is my teacher. I don't think about that. All I can think about is the number, 1,095. How long have I been here? I don't know. A year? Maybe a little less, maybe a little more. What is time anyway? 32 minutes. Silence fills the room. I stay curled on the floor. The girls go back to talking. And then I hear this from Bosnia. So, have you ever had a plan, Champai? A plan? You said you've been trying to get out of here for years. Have you ever come up with a plan? Champai sighs loudly. She doesn't say anything for a long time, and her voice is quiet when she speaks again. There are only two ways to get out. One is to get them to throw you out. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they don't kill you, they just hurt you real bad, and then they throw you out on the street. You probably would die from what they did to you first, but you might not. And if you didn't, then you'd be free. She is quiet for a long time. But I'm just not that brave. There are lots of ways to punish you for doing something stupid. What if instead of hurting me, they kill my family? If they did that, being free wouldn't matter. What's the other way? Bosnia asks. Clients. Sahip and Champai answer at the same time. I lose count. I don't know how many minutes are left in the hour, because now one ear is listening to the girls. And I ask, what could they do? They're not going to help us. Not voluntarily, Champai admits slowly. But, well, some of them have things, you know, like pills or stuff. I used to think I could make them take enough of those pills and then they might help me. She grows quiet, but they might not. And even if they did, Madame would never let us just walk out the front door. And besides, I wouldn't know how much of the pills to make them take or how to get them to take them. No one says anything at all until I hear Vosnia. Not a way out. Sahib's voice is unemotional. It's barely louder than a whisper, but we all hear it. Tried to think of something too, but there's no way out without putting our families in danger. Champai and Sahib are right. There is no way out. But when the door opens and we are told to be quick and come work time, my mind is alive. What if? Champai and Sahib are right. There is no way out. But when the door opens and we are told to be quick and calm, work time, my mind is alive. I keep hearing what the girls say over and over in my head. When the first man picks me, I see him in a new way. He's not scary. He's not mean. He is a way out. I just have to learn how to use him. I don't know why I haven't thought of this myself before now. They are rich, the men, and they are powerful. Even the master will give them whatever they want. The master will give them whatever they want, as long as they have the money. That thought swirls around in my head while he takes my dirty, ragged dress I've worn every day for over a year off. I wonder, how much money does he have right now? That's the thought that's in my head while he's pounding away inside of me. How can I get him to use the money to set me free? That's what I'm wondering. When he dresses again, checks his watch and nods at me, leaves the room. But then, as the door closes behind him and I wait for Madame, I think something else. I wouldn't want him anyway. If a man is going to spend a lot of money to free me, he will want me to work for him at his house. He will buy me to get me out of here, and then I will work for him. That means I need to be careful. I can't just pick any man. I have to think carefully about which man I want to use. I have to pick a man that's not too rough, and it doesn't hit me. Madame comes to get me, take me back to the line, and I'm still thinking about how to choose the man that will set me free. I'm not counting my quota tonight. I don't really even mind the work tonight because I have to see who I think I might could ask. And then I will talk to the girls. They will tell me the best way to do it. We will all wait and get out of this place together. We'll wait for the men we choose. They have to be regulars because we'll need them to come back. We can't do it all tonight. We have to plan. We have to think. We have to be careful. And we have to do it together. I am midway through the quota now, and everything has gone smoothly. There have been two men I think I might could talk to. Neither has ever hit me, and both ask for me a lot. One of them bites, but not hard. I've never bled. Kind of hurts, but not enough to keep me from getting his help. The other one likes to blindfold me, and I don't like that at all. That does scare me. But once I'm blindfolded, he's never done anything really bad to me. It's like he just doesn't want to see my face or me to see his. I don't know. But he's not mean. He's never been really mean. I think the first one, the one that bites, would be more likely to help me, though. I was sad earlier when he left. Now I am standing in line again, waiting for the next client to come in and pick one of us. I am not tired. I can do this. In fact, part of me even wants to do it because it is the only way I know to get out of here. When the dancing man walks into the room to stare at the line, my heart leaps into my throat. The dancing man. Of course. He's calm. He's never rough. He doesn't bite or blindfold me. He even lets me dance. He's the nicest of the men who see me. I've never been scared of him. And he always pays for 2 hours at a time. He's got to be rich. Always picks me. But tonight I am scared that he won't. So as he's looking, I drop my eyes and raise them slowly. Smile a little. It works. He winks at me and then tells Madame I am the one he will use. He pays, and we walk to the room. Once inside, he smiles at me. Sit, he says. He has learned more of my language, and that makes me like him even a little more. I sit on the edge of the bed as he told me to do. My feet are bare. They barely lay flat on the ground. He turns and reaches into the black traveler's bag he has with him and pulls out a wrapped box. I stare at it. I have never seen anything wrapped. On my birthdays, Ew and May gave me acorns. Once I got a pencil, even though I didn't know what it was for. These were never wrapped. But this box the dancing man has is brightly colored in red wrapping paper. It is beautiful. When he turns and holds the box out for me to take, I shake my head, my heart racing. He's giving me a gift? I don't understand why he's giving me a gift. Take it. I am to obey, always and forever. That is a girl's job, to obey. So I reach out and take the rectangle-shaped box and hold it in my hand. I haven't even seen the sun in over a year. I haven't seen anything pretty in over a year. As I stare at the box, tears fill my eyes. I blink fast and hard, trying to get them to go away. Open it, the dancing man says. But I don't know how. I do not know how to open the box. I turn it over and looking at the seams, they are taped on. Gingerly, I take my nail and slide it under the tape. It breaks, but the dancing man laughs. No, no, just rip it open. Rip it. He wants me to rip the beautiful paper. He is probably in a hurry. I'm going slow and taking up his time. I have to hurry. So I grab the edge of the red wrapping paper and rip it. Keep doing it until the paper is all gone. There's a brown box under the paper. And when I open it up, a pair of pink shoes stare back at me. The tears fall. I take my hand and put it over my mouth. They are different than regular shoes. They are soft and they have a pink ribbon. They are ballet shoes, the dancing man says, leaning against the room's only piece of furniture, a table. Put them on. My fingers shake when I touch the soft fabric of the shoes. I pick one up. It is so dainty. They were my daughter's, so they aren't brand new, the dancing man says, as if he's trying to remember the words he needs. I don't care that the shoes aren't new. They look new, and they are new to me. I slip one over my left foot and then the other. I don't know how to tie the laces. He thinks it's funny watching me try. Finally, he leans over and ties the laces for me. For the first time since I left home, I feel just a little pretty. Shoes are magic like that. He sits down beside me and tells me to stand. He leans back against the pillows, crosses his arms behind his head, and says, "Now dance." I am nervous, and I am shy. What if he thinks I'm not good enough at dancing? Will he take the shoes back? But I have no choice. He tells me to dance, so I dance. Dancing hurts now. Didn't used to. Used to be fun, something I would do for no reason. But I wish it was still something fun, something just for me. I wish it didn't mean something. I wish it didn't mean what it means now. Dance isn't mine, it's his. And even though he gave me the shoes, they aren't free. The price of the shoes is higher than any real amount. I dance until he is breathing heavy. He moans deep, sits up, and takes my hand. The chilled, numbed feeling is back. After it is over, he tells me to dance naked for him, wearing just the shoes. So I do. I don't want to. It makes me sad. And it is then that I remember the plans the first time since he chose me in the line. He is not my friend. He is my boss. I don't know if he would help me or not, but he is the one I will use.